Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akio, and if you're interested in developer productivity, platform engineering, as well as the role of an architect in software development, this episode is for you. Joining me today is Dennis van der Laan. He's an Azure App Dev Specialist at Microsoft, and I had such a blast this conversation. Lots of laughs, lots of funny anecdotes, so I'm sure you'll love it. Enjoy! Beyond Coding. So how was it catching up with JP?
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's fun. It's a very energetic person, right? So we only spoke, let's say, 5 minutes because, I had to go downstairs because you were waiting for me, right?
Yeah.
No, but I worked with JP for a year. Uh-huh. And I think one of the first times that I met JP, we directly went to the US for an executive briefing center meeting. Yeah, and I really like this guy. A lot of energy, very positive. Yeah, so it's good to see him again.
Absolutely. That's good.
Yeah, it's really good, yeah.
You mentioned executive briefing center. What is that? Because I've heard that twice now.
Yeah, those are sessions that we organized with our customers. So we invite our customers to come to Redmond or to Munich.
Yeah.
And we craft an agenda depending on the strategic objectives of our customers. We craft an agenda. It can be about security. It can be about software development. And then we invite our customers. We have a full agenda, and we discuss the most important topics for our customers.
Yeah,
it can be new stuff. It can be how we do stuff internally to inspire our customers. That's the idea of the EBC.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, that makes sense. One of the first kind of topics I wanted to touch on was kind of what it's like working at Microsoft and the bigness of the organization. Like everyone always talks about FANG, like Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix.
Yeah.
Google.
Yeah.
Microsoft. Well, Microsoft is not in FANG, I guess.
No.
Now it's Manga, I guess.
Or the Magnificent Seven.
Magnificent Seven. Yeah, I've heard that as well.
Yeah.
But I've never seen it kind of from behind the scenes. But before we touch on that, how did you get in touch with Microsoft anyway? Because I saw you started at consultancy.
Yeah.
Afanada was there as well.
Yeah.
How'd you land in Microsoft?
Yeah, so I worked for 12 years at Evernote, so that's almost where my career started.
Yeah.
And as people hopefully know, is that Evernote is a joint venture between Accenture and Microsoft. So all the projects that Evernote is doing is based on Microsoft technology.
Mm-hmm.
So during my entire career, I'm working with Microsoft technology. And after 12 years doing a lot of different projects, I've been developing almost applications in a database. You can argue if that's a good decision, but front-end development, a CRM implementation, a lot of integration projects with BizTalk Server or the Windows Communication Foundation framework at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I am passionate about Microsoft technology. During my career, I switched to Accenture. I spent 7 years in Groningen at GasUnie. And there was an Accenture project. So I was working for Evernote, but it was an Accenture project. Mm. At that time, I switched to Accenture because Accenture was doing more bigger projects, closer to the business. That's where my passion is. So I moved to Accenture as an architect, and I think it was working for 2 years at Accenture. And then Microsoft reached out, hey, we have a role available, which is Cloud Solution Architect. Do you want to apply for that role? So I applied for that role, started as a Cloud Solution Architect. I'm working now for 5 years at Microsoft, 1 year as a Cloud Solution Architect. Microsoft, every year, there is a change in the organization. So there were some changes in the organization. And then I was thinking, okay, what is my path within Microsoft? Do I want to be what we call a swarming architect, covering multiple accounts with your specialty, right? You can be an integration expert or a Kubernetes expert and swarm across these accounts. Or do I want to become more a developer-focused consultant. Let me put it like that. So a new team was started, which is called, at that time, I think it was Application Development Specialist.
Yeah.
So this new team, and I was invited to talk to the manager of that team who was creating that team. And I was really thinking, yeah, this is where the future is. If you ask me, cloud native development, yeah, this is there will be so many new projects which will be fully cloud native. So this is where I want to be. Mm. So
was that the first team that was specifically focused on cloud native technology, or?
Yeah, so there were people focusing on cloud native technology, yeah. But now it became an official team.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's. So that team was started 4 years ago. So I had the opportunity, do I want to be a swarming architect or do I want to be the app dev specialist? And specialist in within Microsoft means that I'm part of a sales organization.
Mm-hmm.
So I start, you can divide it in three buckets. That's also always how I explain it. So an app innovation specialist or an app dev specialist focuses on starting new cloud native projects.
Okay.
Modernizing existing applications.
Yeah.
And when I say modernizing, I mean leveraging platform as a service components and move away from the underlying infrastructure, right? So you don't need to manage your infrastructure anymore, but leveraging app servers or Kubernetes or whatever.
Yeah.
And the third bucket is developer productivity, leveraging our tools to make sure that your developers are productive.
Mm.
So I thought this is my thing, right? So I need to jump to the other team.
Yeah.
And although it is seen as a sales team, if you ask me 20 years ago, would you ever go to a sales team? I would say no.
Yeah.
No, that's not possible. That's not me. But how I see this role is it's not just saying, hey, we have this new tool. This is a shiny and tool. Do you want to buy it?
Right? Exactly.
That's not how it works
anymore.
That's
kind of snake oil salesman. Yeah.
Exactly. That's traditional, and that's not how I see it. And I also see my colleagues working in a different way. You really need to listen to your customers, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have this toolbox. You can call it Lego blocks, whatever. We have this toolbox of great tools, but you really need to listen to your customer and fully understand what their challenges are or what they want to achieve before you can say, hey, this is a nice brick, it's green, it's yours. That doesn't work. So you really need to listen and map their requirements on the toolbox that you have, right?
Yeah.
And that was exactly what I was doing in my consultancy work as well. So that's, I see consulting is the new selling.
Mm.
I don't see it anymore as I have a product and I'm going to shove it up your throat and this is what you need. No, that doesn't work. No, that's not.
The best salespeople I've talked to on the show and off the show all kind of align with that, that you have to understand what the problem is.
Yeah.
And then it might be a good fit what you have.
Yeah.
Or it might not be a good fit.
Yeah.
And the more you say it's not a good fit, the more that kind of contributes to your, how do you say that? Yeah, it's integrity. It's also credibility.
Yeah.
Right? You build trust in that way.
Exactly.
And when there is a good match, they'll know it's a good match because you said
exactly.
No before.
Exactly.
I think that's the better way to do it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a newer way also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a win-win, right? So because if we help our customers with their challenges,
mm-hmm.
they are successful on our cloud platform.
Of course.
It's a win-win, right?
Yeah.
So the customer wins and we are happy because you're leveraging our tools. So really fixing the puzzle, and that's also what I really like, complex puzzles, make them simple,
mm-hmm.
And try to see if you really can help.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah.
Interesting.
The new selling, yeah.
You mentioned 4 or 5 years ago, you joined this team with the mindset of this is where the future is going to be, right?
Yeah.
Kind of engineers or organizations leveraging cloud technology to be more effective, more productive, with kind of a lesser cost of ownership, at least where they came from, right? When we're talking about traditional infrastructure, you have to maintain all of that.
Yeah.
Maintain all of that.
Yeah.
Now with cloud technologies, I mean, I love working with stuff that's managed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also because then I can work with a smaller team.
Yeah.
And I don't have big team issues.
Yeah. And focus on the most interesting part.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the most complex part and delivering value.
Exactly. Like
that's what excites me.
Yeah.
Do you think it still is the future? I mean, we're now 4 or 5 years ahead. Our organizations now more and more leveraging cloud, because I've also seen this movement and I'm curious to hear what you think. There's a specific guy, I don't know his name, but he keeps posting on LinkedIn stuff about going off the cloud and then saving millions of costs, basically maintaining his own infrastructure off the cloud. So there's also this off the cloud movement nowadays.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I don't understand it.
Yeah.
No, sorry. I still think this is the future. Mm. I've seen different use cases where also people on the cloud do a lot with the infrastructure side, right? Yeah. So they have to manage a lot of stuff themselves. They spin up VMs, cluster of VMs. They deploy different kind of tools on top of it, open source, or and they need to manage everything themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you start leveraging managed services, right, like we already said, you can really focus on adding value, making sure that you have a backup of your database. It should be one click, right? Or not even. It should be out of the box supported. You don't need to worry about it. And maybe it's a fancy term, but reduce cognitive load. Make sure that you can focus on building an application that adds value to your organization. That's what you need to do as a developer, if you ask me. And managing the underlying infrastructure. Yeah, I think that's I will not say a waste of time, but
it's a technical problem.
Exactly.
That's what I feel like.
And what I really like about I often use the paste layered application strategy. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that structure.
Let's lay it out.
Yeah, and to be honest, when I started using it, it had three layers, and maybe I heard it's updated. I think there is a fourth layer, but. It is the first layer is the system of record. Well, that's a term that we all know in the IT industry, and those are the applications that are managing the master data and supporting a lot of business processes, important business processes in your organization. You can think of an ERP system.
Yeah,
and also what Gartner states is that just buy such a system, implement it in your organization, make sure that you use it properly. But don't build it yourself. That doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah.
Maybe it's fun to do, but it doesn't add any value. You can buy an ERP system from Microsoft. You can buy it from SAP or another vendor. Don't spend too much time because you will not differentiate yourself from your competitor by building your own ERP system.
Exactly. It's not your core.
Exactly. And so the second layer is the system of differentiation.
Mm.
And this is where you can... like the layer already mentions, this is where you can differentiate from your competitors. So what are the applications that you as an organization, what are your applications that differentiate you from your competitors? And that's where you want to custom build your applications, right? Because you want to be different than your competitor. And I think if we go back to your question, if you can really focus on your application that differentiate you from your competitor so that you can gain market share.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you want to spend too much time on managing the underlying infrastructure for that application?
Yeah.
No, you should spend as much time as possible making this application as good as possible to help your customers and differentiate you from your competitors. So I think, that's how I view it. So I see definitely cloud native development as the future. And the third layer to finalize the model is the system of innovation. And this is where you spin up new ideas. You test it. It can be successful. If it's successful, okay, then you make it part of your IT landscape. If it's not successful, you throw it away and you think about new innovative ideas. I use that paste layered application strategy very often in my conversations because if I talk to my customers, I'm not interested in having discussions about an ERP system. At least that's not my role within Microsoft. I want to talk about what are the applications that differentiate you from your competitors?
Yeah.
And how can we help as Microsoft to make you even better, more successful? And that's where I'm passionate about, talk about these applications.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. That's what gives organizations the edge.
Yeah, exactly.
And when you touched upon kind of the layer of differentiation, one of the thoughts I had was there's also, and there's always been, a community of people that love low code to kind of, use, as you mentioned, these building blocks to then leverage whatever they need in a more fast way. Right? Talk about productivity. If you don't have to build it yourself, if you can just click it together, then all of a sudden you have an application and you can get up and running faster.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's used kind of in that experimentation layer, because I can see it working and being productive in kind of prototyping. something you can throw away and then build a more resilient variant, or even that you could argue.
Mm-hmm.
But where do you think kind of low code fits in there? And do you still see this trend of low code also kind of gaining market share in that way?
Yeah, I think that low code has absolutely, if you talk about these three layers, you can build an application which is a differentiating application with low code.
Absolutely.
That perfectly makes sense. It's not only the innovation layer that you say, okay, I'm just going to try something with low code, see if it's working and keep it small.
Mm-hmm.
No, I really have customers that are fully focusing on low code, and it's a differentiating application for them, and they build it fully with low code. So there's definitely part for low code.
Journey.
And what is your view on it?
I think I always thought low code was interesting. I almost became, let's say, a low code developer, like very early on in my career. But then I was like, is this really going to give me an edge, or are a lot of people able to do so? And because of that thought, I went the more specialist route, let's say, specifically for software engineering.
Yeah.
Now that kind of generative AI has been booming in 2023, I am more fearful of these low code applications, because if you can generate code that is more specific and more adaptive, let's say, in kind of a co-pilot way with an AI, then does low code still have a foot to stand on? I think established technologies, yes. But for example, I know a friend and he's building a code automation platform. He doesn't call it low code because it generates code.
Yeah.
For those applications, I'm like, man, with generative AI now, that I see a big risk there.
Yeah. Yeah, but I also think that you need to think about who is the end user in this case, right? So yes, with tools like GitHub Copilot, you can build a lot of applications faster.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still coding, right? So you still need to have that coding background. You're still responsible for the code, right?
Yeah.
And I think low coding is a different persona who's using it, right? So I think those are more the business users who are using this and can also contribute to add value to the organization by building an application.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I still think there's a lot of room for low coding as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also funny if you start talking about low coding with customers, and it depends on the role. If you go to an engineering lead or something like that, and you mention something like low coding, it's a dirty
taboo
word.
Yeah, it's like taboo.
Yeah. Sometimes you really see, no, we don't do low coding. Yeah. No, that's not coding. No.
Yeah. I don't know where that comes from. Like, people are maybe fearful of like being obsolete. That's the feeling I get then.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we don't do low, like maybe they're better than low code because it has this kind of negative connotation sometimes.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, if people use it, if it does what it needs to do, then I don't care. I'm not going to use it. I've tried to click around and I can see the power of it.
Yeah.
But it's not principally. It's just because I like building things in a different way.
Yeah.
If I needed to build something really quickly and there was a low-code tool, let's say I was comfortable with, or that got the job done way faster than I could, it's the same as using generative AI to spit out a bunch of code. But
Yeah.
It's just to get the job done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Be fearful.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And talking about Gen AI, are you using GitHub Copilot already for a long time, or what's your experience?
I haven't integrated Copilot in let's say my IDE, because I mean I'm a consultant and the previous client I worked for didn't allow that yet. The conversation was still ongoing. Embrace or be fearful, like that was an ongoing topic. But we have this, I call it, it's a Slack plugin in the organization. It's called Slack GPT. And because it's through our organization, we kind of get to decide, okay, how much of this information gets stored, how long and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So with that, I asked basic questions or stuff, because in my previous project, I needed to do a lot of low level stuff when it comes to, it was an IoT project. So really on memory level, people had optimized certain way of working with data. And I needed to understand that. And I basically used this Slack GPT to ask a bunch of questions and to gain an understanding. And it was wrong the first few times. And then all of a sudden it was right a bunch of times. And I got it working because of that as well, in a faster way, because my Google searches just ended up in nothing. And otherwise I needed to go deeper, let's say down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I do love this notion of Copilot. I think the marketing and the name is genius. because it's a co-pilot, which means you're steering.
Sometimes
you're
a bit confusing. You have so many co-pilots.
yeah, fair enough. But still, like the person in control is the pilot, and you're using this co-pilot also in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we have a lot of conversations about co-pilot, and also people are concerned about if I make this tool available to my engineers, do they still feel that they are the owner of the code, right?
Oh, okay.
Or they're just accepting every suggestion. Oh, yeah, it looks great, right? So move on, let's push it to production. Let me put it very black and white.
Is that the fear?
Yeah, some customers are really concerned about that. So that's...
From my perspective, let's say from an engineering perspective, I like to own whatever I do. So if it would spit it out, I would still be like, okay, is this good or not? Or do I need to tweak it or not?
Yeah.
Most of the times, it wasn't enough and I needed to tweak it for my context.
Exactly.
Like, we're still at that phase.
Yeah.
But I do see it getting better and better. Like, that's, I think, natural. But I wouldn't necessarily push anything to production. I mean, it's also just basic engineering standards nowadays. You create a test so you see if it works or not before you push it. So that notion is kind of, I feel like, maybe outdated or maybe a very hands-off kind of point of view, let's say.
Yeah.
But that's my opinion.
Now I agree with you, right? So we also got questions about if I use Copilot, do I still need to use a tool like GitHub Advanced Security, for instance?
Yeah.
Yeah, you still need to use your proper tools, right? So and it's not that I'm making a joke about that question pops up, but you see people are thinking about, okay, where does it help me? But it's just the coding part, right? So you still need to have your quality checks. You still need to have your security checks. You need to have everything in place. It's just helping you with staying in the flow and making sure that you become more productive and you don't need to go to Stack Overflow all the time. But yeah, you still need to use the other tools as well before you bring it to production. And I still, like you also mentioned, right, you're still the owner of the code because, if you bring this to a test environment and it breaks or it doesn't deliver the functionality that was the original idea, you can't blame Copilot, right?
No, it's on you.
Yeah, it's on you. Yeah.
Absolutely. So,
yeah.
I was wondering, because you said you transitioned from this architecture role and now more of a customer-facing sales role as well.
Yeah.
Specifically also for developer productivity. Is there any, like, let's say, correlation or kind of similarity in the customers you've talked to when it comes to making their developers more productive? Are they, for example, already using cloud technologies or are they using it optimally? Because using it optimally sometimes is not the same. Effectively, maybe I should say, rather. Mm-hmm. Or what are kind of the similarities that you've seen? Or is it context-dependent and very different at times as well?
I think I see a lot of similarities, to be honest. So the and maybe it's good to clarify a bit on the accounts that we focus on, right? So we focus on the customers who are already in their cloud journey for a long time, right?
Yeah.
So you see that across all my customers.
Okay.
And when it comes to developer productivity, everybody has embraced the DevOps teams. They're also looking into platform engineering. They're all exploring the tool GitHub Copilot, of course. So I see a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
You also see some customers who are more focused on first lift and shift. And that's also the trigger. What's the trigger to go to the cloud, right? So maybe you need to close your data center, your contract, and so you need to go quick.
Yeah.
Then of course, you have customers who are fully focused on infrastructure and they don't fully embrace the power of the cloud. And they're still, you can still do things traditionally in the cloud, right? You can even do an deployment with a manual next to you, right? But the majority of my customers are focusing on cloud native development, leveraging the managed services. And like we all know, there's also a war on talent.
Yeah.
So if you want to be an attractive organization for developers, you also need to bring some tools and best practices into your organization to make sure that these people want to work for you.
Yeah.
And I see the customers that I'm covering manufacturing customers, are all focusing on cloud native development, embracing DevOps, like I mentioned, and platform engineering. And platform engineering, to be honest, they're exploring it, right? So, okay. And I think platform engineering is not as easy just to say, hey, we're going to introduce a platform team and we will be successful. So that can be pretty complex. So they are exploring it. So yeah.
Also successfully, you think? Because I think platform engineering is very interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I fully agree with you.
Yeah. So are they doing it successfully, you'd say? Or what have you seen so far?
I think my customers are all in at the beginning of this journey.
Okay.
So I didn't see... I didn't see already a full functioning platform team at my customers. And of course, they're doing bits and pieces. Let me, because it is a very big concept, right?
Absolutely. So sure.
I have Terraform modules. I'm doing platform engineering.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But fully functioning like Gregor Hope before is describing in his book.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet. Mm. To be honest, and if I take a look internally, we have a team who is focusing on making other teams more productive, right? Mm.
Yeah,
that's what we briefly touched upon, which is called 1ES.
Yeah.
So I think we are doing this already for at least 10 years, but our customers are exploring it.
Yeah.
What's your experience? Because you are also now working at ING. Do you see a platform engineering team at ING or
not yet? But I'm seeing, let's say, pain points of us not being able to experiment or innovate. I like the way my friend Carlos Kelkbaum, he was in a previous episode, he says the way I kind of view innovation is how fast, how quickly you can go from an idea, concept to, let's say, live, a prototype, maybe in production in the hands of the user.
Yeah.
Right. And the faster you can do that, the more innovative the organization is.
Exactly.
And the way you can do that, let's say the way platform engineers can contribute to that, is making a platform, making, sometimes people call it a landing zone, that is very easy to deploy to, where deployments are standardized, where you can take something off the shelf and all of a sudden you need your, let's say, code up and running within maybe a shell structure, maybe a predefined thing. But then you're at least up and running, right? So that contributes to productivity, contribution, innovation in that way. And from what I've seen right now, my current role, and I'm not a software engineer anymore, so I have this, I think I always thought about productivity, more so on my own, more so on the team, but now I'm thinking about, okay, overarching productivity. Because that's going to contribute to the product.
Yeah.
And if we don't have something like that, if it's not very easy to go from, okay, the idea, the concept to kind of live in production, then from a product point of view, I cannot get into that experimentation phase. And I've learned that you can either do a lot of research and then still end up being wrong, or you can just throw out ideas as fast as possible and then experiment and test your assumptions and then see if you're right or wrong.
Yeah.
And I want to be in the latter phase where it's easy to go from idea to production.
Yeah.
And then experiment those assumptions, test them, and see if it's value or not.
Yeah, and what is your experience? Because I also see that you also get the argument, if you talk about platform engineering, that you are using reusable building blocks, or you're going to standardize, that people say, hey, I'm going to lose my autonomy, I'm less flexible, I'm forced in this direction.
Yeah.
Have you seen that also at your customers or?
Not yet. Like I've been part of, let's say, an organization where I was part of the software development team. And then we had a specific part of the team, which was focused on the platform, making it as easy for me to deploy to as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is my bias because I like business problems. I don't want to care about technical problems. So how do we land? How does it scale?
Yeah.
What is this build pipeline? What does it look like? I'm interested because I'm just curious in general, but it doesn't necessarily need to be my responsibility to do so. If people feel like, okay, this is my, let's say, part of the pie, and all of a sudden other people are eating it now, or I think eating is still the best analogy. But then I think you have a people problem,
And you have to figure out how to get that win-win, let's say, because that's not a technical problem.
Yeah.
I think it makes sense for people to focus on kind of what they need to do instead of being focused on everything. Because I think if you focus on everything, your productivity kind of goes down. You can't work on everything at the same time, every little bit, because then nothing moves.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like your comment. It's a people problem, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that platform engineering is if you want to implement this successfully, it is about technical building blocks. It is about culture. It's about processes. It's everything, right?
Yeah.
And that's also if you take a look at how we do this internally, if we have conversation about our approach, it's not only about the technical stuff, right? And of course, we have tools for our customers, GitHub, Azure DevOps. We have a lot of these technical building blocks, but if we really want to help our customers with successful implementing a platform engineering strategy, you also need to help the customer with processes and think about what do you need to change in your culture. So it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm also happy that we now have on Microsoft Learn now a document at least to structure this a bit, right? So to share a bit how we would structure this.
Yeah.
So it's not only about the technical building blocks. So I think that's a great thing that we have it on Microsoft Learn right now. But it is a complex journey.
Yeah.
Where do you apply platform engineering and where don't you apply platform engineering is an interesting topic as well.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned when it comes to kind of the culture of an organization or how to structure things, I think way of working is always an interesting concept because from a consultant's perspective, you go in and out. So obviously you get a preference, but from your side to then advise customers in this way of working, which might be standardized, but it needs to be kind of context dependent.
Yeah.
What is that based on? Is that based on how Microsoft does things, kind of team organization structure, or what you've seen in other customers that you've kind of gathered and standardized in advice in that way, or what is it based on?
Yeah. So how I approach this for my customers, at least, is sharing experiences, how we do things.
Yeah.
Of course, the platform engineering strategy, which is on Microsoft Learn right now, I have to ask the guys who developed it, but I assume it's based on what we do internally.
Yeah.
But if I have conversations about platform engineering with my customers, I connect them also with our leaders in the software development domain and share experience. Hey, this is what went well.
Yeah.
And this is where we made a mistake and we had to revise our vision. So I think that's also a role for us, right? So it's not, again, about the selling part. It's not only about talking about our products, but it's also about sharing experiences, is how we do things. And I see that our customers are really appreciating that. So we have conversations between our customers and our platform engineering team. But we also have conversations with people who leverage our platform engineering team internally with our customers. Hey, what is your experience? How does it help you? Are you more productive or not? Sharing experiences is what I do very often with my customers. And I'm not the one who's sharing that. I'm connecting the leaders with the leaders at the customer.
I think it's always interesting to think about experiences and how that might help form a perspective on how things work or how things might work. Or one of the things I really have kind of a hard time with is sometimes letting go of your ideas. Because if you have an idea, then just by virtue of you having that idea, you're kind of biased because you think it's going to work. And then being able to let that go. And I've seen that in organizations where some, let's say, it could be from an engineering team, could be from an architecture role. People have ideas and they don't want to let go when it doesn't actually, let's say, work or doesn't deliver the value that they think it does.
Yeah.
And then
it's their baby.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard to kill your babies.
Yeah.
But in that way, I feel like most of the times when we're talking about the technical stuff, that's kind of standardized, right? You have these tools, you can use them in X, Y, and Z, but the way you use them and the way you structure them, I feel like more and more, that's where the challenge is within organizations now as well.
Yeah. I fully agree.
Yeah.
I fully agree with you. Yeah.
I was wondering also, because you said you came from kind of an architecture role,
yeah,
I feel like the role of architecture, at least from what I've seen, is kind of evolving as well. And I don't know if, let's say, the hands-off architecture approach is as effective anymore. You already said you need to understand customers. I think more and more an architect or the people that have that responsibility need to do that 100% as well.
Yeah.
Figure out what works, what doesn't work. But I don't know if this, let's say, hands-off part is as effective anymore as it used to be a few years back down the line.
And what do you mean with hands-off in this case?
So I feel like more and more software engineers that I've talked to also take up that, let's say, architecture mantle,
yeah,
or are interested in that. So then they do the hands-on as well as kind of the,
yeah,
figuring out the non-functionals as well as the functionals.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you have this kind of man in the middle,
yeah,
that needs to translate because, yeah, the developers need to understand whatever the architect understands,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, in their ivory tower. Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, so if I take a look at my own career, so I started as a developer, then lead developer, then became software architect, but yeah, I also moved more to a technical architect role, and lead architect. So, and as a lead architect, I was not focused anymore on the software development part, but really on the entire landscape. So,
yeah,
so to give you an example, I worked for 5 years on at Gasunie,
okay,
where we implemented a new SCADA system, which is managing the physical gas network in the Netherlands, right? So opening and closing valves, starting compressor stations, etc. So my role was not anymore focused on server development, but yeah, we had to build an entire solution which integrates with the network, the gas network. So I was not focusing anymore on the software development part. But what I really like about moving to more an architect role, and I know we briefly touched upon it a couple of weeks ago when we first met. I remember a presentation from Jim Wild. At that time he was working at Microsoft, and he was talking about the five pillars of architecture. And it was, I think it was 15 years ago, so it's okay, a long time ago. So,
yeah,
so forgive me for my memory, but I remember that there was one pillar, which was human dynamics. And at that time I was a software developer, and I was really thinking about, I want to grow into an architectural role, and I want to become an architect, but human dynamics, I was really thinking about, that should be easy, right? I'm okay with talking to people, so
I got this.
Yeah. Well, I totally underestimated that part. So when I became an architect, I had these pitfalls. Sometimes I had a great idea in my mind, and I was really thinking, this is how we should solve this. But somebody else also had an idea about how we can solve a certain problem. But I was fully focused on my own idea, right? So, and he said, okay, take a look. I think we should solve it like this. And I was only listening with one ear, and I was really thinking, yeah, no. Okay. And I always said, yes, but. And then we moved to my architecture, right? And so, yeah, that wasn't working at all. So as an architect, the human dynamics part, yeah, I think that's also an important one. You need to have the technical background, like you also mentioned, the hands-off doesn't work. But the human dynamics part, and that's also what Jim Wild at that time said. I'm pretty sure that he said it like that. That the human dynamics was the most important part. You need to convince people about your ideas, right?
Yeah.
This is the direction where we need to go. And you need to convince people with different backgrounds, not only technical folks, but also security people or business people. This architecture is going to cost this amount of money, so you also need to get some budget. So you really need to sell your architecture to multiple stakeholders. And yeah, so I really learned the human dynamics part. it's extremely important. Yeah, that's really true. Yeah,
that's funny. I really appreciate you sharing that. Like the idea part, I think that everyone is going to see that. Everyone thinks their idea is right.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, when the person across from you has a different idea, then it's interesting.
Yeah.
But to explore that, I think takes a certain skill.
Yeah.
If you say yes, but, and then you go back to your idea, no one's listening to each other.
Yeah, big mistake.
Exactly. Yeah. So then you just, either it's a conflict or someone gives in and they talk shit about your behind your back.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all the human factor.
Exactly. And what I learned in I'm pretty sure you also, Xabia, you also have these consulting trainings or whatever, how they call it. I learned in one of the trainings, I said, okay, Dennis, but if somebody has a different idea than you have, you should ask questions, a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And two things can happen. By asking these questions, you get answers and you are convinced that the idea of the other person might be a good idea.
Yeah.
That could happen. Or you can ask questions and say, hey, I'm looking at your architecture, but what about availability? How do you make this high available? And then you also can steer them in a direction that they also open up and say, oh yeah, you're right. I didn't think about it, right? So there are, and both is positive, right?
Yeah.
You can steer them also with asking questions into your architecture if that's your purpose. Or you can ask questions and be convinced about the architecture that the other one created. So that was a really good learning. And I didn't learn it at a technical course, but it was really on soft skills. Again, human dynamics.
I think that's a great example of sometimes you push, right? Because you want the other person to hear your ideas.
Yeah.
But push might not always be the best option. Sometimes you have to pull that information.
Yeah.
And then maybe sometimes meet in the middle or maybe even choose your battles. Like, is this the battle to go all in on?
Yeah.
More and more. Like, I've been labeled as being idealistic or being like very fighting for what I think is right. And more I feel like sometimes I'm just exhausted. If you're fighting every fight, it just gets exhausting.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you lose battles all around.
Yeah.
Instead of fighting, let's say, battles or fighting for what you believe is right when it counts.
Yeah, and let's be honest, you need a lot of people around you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If you keep fighting with everybody,
no one's going to like you.
No, you're not going to be successful. Yeah. But it also, like you also mentioned, if you have an architecture, you designed it, it also becomes your baby, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't want to kill your own baby. So, fighting. With all the peoples and think you are right, and that's not going to make you successful at all.
No. It's hard, right? Because I think the whole conversation here has been more so about human dynamics, let's say, quote unquote, here and there. And that is also very human to feel like or to think that you're right.
Yeah.
And what I've learned, and this is, I mean, I've never had trouble with saying, okay, your idea is better. I changed my mind. Sometimes have to say out loud, okay, I changed my mind. So people realize that I'm not actually arguing with them anymore.
Yeah.
And I have no trouble doing that because I think like for ideas, I don't really care who's right. I want the best idea to
absolutely
win. But I will fight if I think my idea is best.
Yeah.
That's the important part.
Yeah. And also an interesting situation where the human dynamics again becomes very important is that I think... we all know that there are architectural review boards or some kind of board where you need to get that stamp to move forward with your idea. Mm. And let's say there are 8 people in this round table of architects where you need to get that stamp.
Yeah.
During my career, I also learned it the hard way that if there are 8 people who need to approve your idea, it's not about the meeting where you present your idea to get the stamp. It's all about how you go to that meeting. If 4 people from the 8 have an opinion about your architecture and the other 4, they're not experts in that domain, so they just follow the other 4. Mm. You need to have that conversation with the 4 people before you have that meeting, right? You need to influence them already before you have that meeting.
Mm.
And I saw a guy presenting his idea for the architecture review board. Deep technical guy, knows his domain, but he didn't talk to any of the architects around the table before that meeting. So they were surprised about his idea. Why did you came up with this? And a bit annoyed, and they sent him away.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah. From both sides.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
completely.
Yeah, so he missed the part where he need to influence the people before he go to that meeting, right?
Yeah.
That was also an interesting learning to see you have a good idea, but you didn't do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
So your idea was killed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But no one's going to teach you that, right? No. Because probably from his mindset, it's like, okay, everyone prepares and then they pitch there and that's where the decision gets made.
Yeah.
And I think 100% the same goes for security and risk and compliance.
Yeah.
When you're working on something new, you have to take them with you.
Yeah.
It cannot be the final hurdle because then you get blocked.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's done.
You need to make them part of your journey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's but again, no one's going to teach you that. When I'm starting at ING now, and I talked to my colleagues, and one of the people actually worked at ING, and he gave me this advice. He's like, whatever you do, since I'm not going to be product manager, make sure to make friends with risk and compliance and security, because they will block you if you don't take them with you. If all of a sudden it's out of the blue and you have this thing and it's now or never, they're going to say never, and it sucks to be you. So
yeah, it's really funny. So If you're in this IT department and you're starting your IT career, I think that would be good advice, right? It's not only about the technology. It's not only about the programming language. It's not only about you building this awesome microservice architecture. People are extremely important to become successful in this.
100%.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed this, Dennis, I must say. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Was this kind of what you expected going into it as well?
To be honest, I wasn't expecting. We had a conversation some time ago.
Yeah,
and I was thinking this can go
everywhere.
Right?
That's usually how.
Yeah. And I also listened to some other podcasts, and it's going in a normal way. You ask questions, you get a question back. It can go everywhere.
Yeah.
So I wasn't expecting anything, right?
Well, I hope you enjoyed it.
No, absolutely. It was fun. It's good fun stuff to do. And thanks for the invitation.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah.
Cool. Then I'm going to round it off here. Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to put all Dennis's socials in the description below. Reach out to him. Let him know you came from our show. And with that being said, thank you for listening. We'll see you on the next one.